Hey, you are listening to The Workplace Leader. This is the podcast where we go behind the scenes of corporate real estate, talking to industry experts about how they shape the next generation workplace.
I'm your host, Sabine M., and in today's episode, I'm speaking with Enrique Rubio. Enrique is the founder of Hacking HR. Hi, everyone. Today, I'm with a podcast pro, Enrique Rubio. He is releasing a podcast a day. We will ask him later how he does it. And he's created this great community in HR, basically. We'll ask him about as well. We got introduced actually by Tonil, who's been on the podcast recently. So hi, Enrique. Thanks for taking the time.
Hello, Sabine. Thank you so much for inviting me. I am excited to be with you and learn from each other.
Definitely. Yeah, I'm excited. I think I'm more excited to have you the other way around. Maybe because I've talked to you before, but for our audience to frame this, like, what do you do? How did you get there? It's kind of my usual starting point.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, once again, thank you so much for inviting me. My name is Enrique Rubio, and I am the founder of a global learning community of HR leaders and professionals from all over the world. And it's called Hacking HR. We bring all this community together through events, learning programs, our social platform called the Hacking HR Lab, and a lot of other things that we do. You know, we invent along the way, and I'm the founder. So I bring the people together, design part of the learning programs. I am developing this social platform that I mentioned before. And I got here, well, when I created Hacking HR, I was working as a corporate HR practitioner. And I realized that because my background is also electronic engineering, that's what I did for a long time before moving to HR, I realized that the gap between HR and technology not only was wide, that was widening pretty quickly. So back in 2017, at the end of 2017, I said, well, I want to create a space for conversations that have to do with HR and technology. And that's how Hacking HR came to exist. And now we really covered everything, not just technology, but that's how it originated. So that's a little bit about me. That's a little bit about Hacking HR and a little bit about how I got here.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty impressive because Hacking HR is a huge community.
Yeah.
How did you start that? How did you plant that seed? How did you get people on board?
Trying. I think it was generally people, like, we're still growing and, you know, it's been a lot of grind and hard work because, first of all, nobody knew who I was before I created this thing, right? I was just one more employee in corporate America. So then I created this community. And at the very beginning, it was not easy actually to find, for example, a location to do. We used to do very small events, like for 50, 100 people. And that's how we started. Now we do all of the stuff that we do is mostly online, but we started with in-person events. So number one, nobody in the venues that I was trying to get to for free knew who I was. So that was a little bit of a challenge. Then when I was inviting speakers to participate in the conversations, none of them knew who I was or what the brand was about, right? I'm not saying that everybody knows now, but we have a brand and people recognize our brand. And even if they have not taken part of it, they may know what it is. But I think it was all about putting myself out there and saying, you know what? I'm just going to, you know, the venues that we were using before, we used to do the events at the WeWork locations or sometimes other co-working spaces. So what I did was I created a list of all the co-working spaces in the cities where I wanted to do this. And I started sending them emails and saying, hey, we want to do this event. We want to do it for free in the evening. Is there any chance that you guys can give us this for free? Sometimes they would say no. Some other times they would say, yeah. And we're also going to give you food and beer for free. And I'm like, wow. I was like, okay, well, I didn't expect that, but thank you, right? If I hadn't asked, that wouldn't have happened. And the same thing with the speakers that I brought on board, right? Some people said no, some people ignored my invitations, and some other people said yes. And that's what happens when you want to build something and you put yourself out there and start building it, you know, without even if you don't have all the resources or all the answers, or it doesn't really matter. You know, just put yourself out there and start putting the work in. That's how I did it.
Yeah. I mean, that's similar to, I'm imagining, to now thinking about workplace experience, starting with like, okay, trying things out, and maybe your colleagues, your employees are going to say, no, this is not what I want, but you're putting it out there and maybe they're going to say, yes, this is great. Yeah. Now, you mentioned you've started with in-person events that were for sure not possible during the pandemic, and now you're all digital. How has that impacted what you're doing, the community? What are the effects that you're seeing?
Yeah, well, we grew faster by doing it online than doing it in person, because now we can reach more people. It's cheaper to reach more people online. And most of our events, 99.9% of all we do is free. And what that means is that there's no barriers for anybody to join what we do, right? I know we are releasing this podcast mid-March. We are recording it at the end of February. But in 1 week from now, from the time that we're recording this podcast, we are launching our annual conference, which is the third edition of the conference. The first one that we did in 2020 was all online, free. We got about 11,000 people registered. Last year, we had about 24,000 people registered, and now we are over 40,000 people registered. So this would not have been possible at all, ever, for us with our size in person. So doing it online has been critical for our growth. At the same time, of course, now because everybody's online, we are competing with many more organizations for attention, and a lot of not only event organizers, but now companies are like, well, you know, now I can do my own events, even if it's just 1 hour every week. So it's a lot of competition going on right now. So that's a challenge. And on the other hand, the other challenge, which was kind of the downside for us when we moved all online, was that the chapters that we had created around the world, they were doing events in person. And when COVID started and we moved online, they were like, well, you know, we don't want to do this online because, you know, it doesn't make sense for us to have a local chapter that is meeting online, because then the local sort of spirit of it doesn't really matter anymore. So the chapters basically stopped working, and now we do everything global. But hopefully next year, 2023, we can go back to in-person smaller events with chapters once the pandemic is a little bit more under control.
I've recently read as well an article, where was it? I think it was on Forbes, about like a look into the future for events with an angle on like, what's the metaverse going to bring? And the prediction there was actually that the future of these kind of events and gatherings is going to be a mix of things. So some digital, some in-person, some metaversal stuff. And the metaversal things, mostly for the like experience and connection part of it. Do you currently have kind of a secret sauce how you add that flavoring to the events?
Yeah. Well, the first two, the in-person and the virtual experience. And when I say virtual, I mean still 2D, meaning just seeing each other on a screen. We're going to continue doing that. And in fact, I'm hoping that we can do our annual conference both in person and hybrid, like again, two-dimensional in 2023. I think for metaverse stuff, I think there's still a journey that we have to go through, not just event organizers, but the technology has to go through a lot of sort of iterations to get there. Let me give you one example. Right now, to be in the metaverse, you still have to wear those big goggles. Mm-hmm. And for example, to have those goggles on, literally after 1 hour, you have a headache because it's heavy in your head and it's uncomfortable. Of course, I am imagining a very futuristic thing happening literally in the next 2, 3, maybe 5 years, where it's literally just like wearing glasses that are like sunglasses. And those will be the goggles to connect 3D or metaverse wise in the future. But right now, if we were to do an event in the metaverse with this kind of goggles, first of all, you have to pay big money because they are not cheap. And even if you had the money to pay for them, your Wi-Fi connection or your connectivity has to be very reliable and, you know, significant bandwidth. And on top of that, you probably wouldn't be able to connect more than an hour or so because you're going to get tired of having those things on your head.
Yeah.
So right now, I don't see ourselves doing any of that. I think it's going to be, hopefully in the next 2, 3 years, we're going to be in a much better place. But that's where we're going. We're going to probably that very holistic experience of having events that are in person with components that are two-dimensional, digital, and three-dimensional, like in the metaverse. But I think metaverse-wise, we still have a little bit of a way to go.
Yeah. You're talking probably to one of the biggest skeptics. I still have my iPhone 6 because I don't want to lose the home button and the plug for the ear.
The only reason why I don't have an iPhone 6 anymore is because mine, when I used to work in the company before, they would force us to upgrade to the new one. And I used to have the iPhone, I think it was like the 8 or whatever, you know, like for like 3 years. And then it fell in the bathtub and it broke and got water. So I had to get a new one. Otherwise, I would probably be using like BlackBerry right now, you know, or something like that. So I love technology. I am deeply passionate about technology. I'm a user of technology. I read about technology, but there are things that I'm skeptical as well. For example, you know, we talk about the metaverse. I mean, there are still half of the world doesn't have access to the internet yet. So do you think how are we going to get them in the metaverse? Then the other half that is connected online, most of them are connected via their smartphones because they either don't have reliable computing systems in their homes and whatnot. So when we talk about the metaverse and the impact of the metaverse, I think we are still very elitist in the way of this is just for developed countries where bandwidth and broadband is accessible. Even in America today, you know, there's still a large chunk of cities and regions in this country that don't have access to broadband. So you can imagine how they in America, in the US, will connect to something like the metaverse. So we still have a long way to go for these technologies to, you know, have a significant impact.
Yeah.
But you know, we offer the next best thing, which I think is still 2D, being online, removing any barrier for participation. I think that's still a pretty good thing. I think the fact that we're putting together what has become one of the largest HR conferences in the world, what we do in Hacking HR, we do it for free. It's all online. Literally, it doesn't matter where you are. You can be both in New York City, where you get probably 5G and the best connections in the world. You can be in Venezuela, my birth country, where still a lot of people don't have access to broadband. Or you can be maybe, I don't know, in who knows where. And with your phone, you can connect to what we do. So, you know, we're using technology, what we have right now, in that way.
What I thought about as well is like organizations are still, or at least what I'm hearing in the media, the return to office is a big theme. And I'm sure that comes up in the event conversations you're having as well as a topic also, but I want to explore that. What my thought was like, companies are still having a hard time thinking of a remote workforce. How are they moving to the metaverse next step? But we don't need to talk about that, actually. What I would be more interested in is like, did you see the conversations in the HR hacking community change over the past 2 years?
Well, yes. You know, in Hacking HR, we have been talking a lot about new things like mental health, culture, diversity, inclusion, skilling and reskilling. We talk about the future of work, but more in the context of how do we make it happen today? So yeah, there's been a lot of conversations that are grounded in the reality of what we're going through. You know, there's a lot of stuff about how to lead in COVID times, remote work, but I'm going to say that probably 90% of the conversations are just a continuation of what we were talking about before the pandemic. They actually were amplified by the pandemic. Before COVID, I mean, people were burnt out at work. Now they are more burnt out than ever before, but they were burnt out before. They were depressed before. They were disengaged before. Diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging was an issue before. The lack of or the necessity to upskill and reskill the workforce for the new skills was a reality before. Now it's amplified by the pandemic. So to all those conversations that we were having before COVID, we just added the layer of how COVID has amplified some of these needs that we know existed before. You have some cases that are significantly amplified. For example, remote work is one of them. Before the pandemic, something like 2-3% of the workforce had the opportunity to work remotely. Not that they did, but they had the opportunity. Now, like about 40-50% of the workforce is working remotely. So you can tell that there's a significant amount of more conversations about remote work that didn't happen before, but that didn't mean that we were not talking about those things before. So there are many conversations that were amplified by COVID. And I think what I believe is that the realization here for me is that we should not be oblivious to what we know it's important but we haven't talked too much about, because that's what happened before COVID. You know, like we swept under the rug conversations such as, you know, mental health at work, right? For us, only for a handful of people that was important. Now it is like, oh, now we got to talk about mental health at work. Yeah, but you know, why did we have to wait for COVID to show us that we needed to talk about this, right? We should have been addressing all these topics before. Like, for example, the fact that people are looking now, this is a very critical trend. People are looking now for more meaning, for more purpose, for more impact through the work that they do. They don't want their work contract to be only a transaction where you deliver an outcome or a product and you're paid for it. People want to now not only acknowledge sort of those relationships, but also say, how am I making the world a better place with the work that I do? This was a reality before COVID. Now it became much more of a significant reality because people are saying, I'm not going to be work. My life is not devoted to work anymore if that job is not making a difference in the world. So all of these conversations, most of them existed before COVID. It's just that now COVID amplified them.
That's why it's very curious to me as well that companies leaders want to go back to the way things were before, because we do know that the way we worked before was not healthy, because as you said, there was employee mental health issues, there was burnout, and there was toxic workplaces and environments that were not ideal to be productive in. Why would we ever want to go back to that when we just see now how much better it could be if we allow for flexibility?
Yeah, well, that's, to me, there's a couple of things that are really, we shouldn't say them in that way. One of them is the return to normal. That normal was not working for everybody. In fact, it was working for a very few people, to be honest. So especially the people that want to keep the status quo as it was before, they want to go back to that. You think, for example, who is talking about forcing people to go back to the office? Some business leaders who don't want to change. I was going to say who are incapable of changing, but I don't think they are incapable of changing. It's just that they don't want to change. They don't want to upgrade their leadership style to now leading an organization that is hybrid, where some people are working remotely or some people have the flexibility to decide how they want to work. So they are pretty much the ones talking about going back to normal. So I'm hoping that people stop saying that because it doesn't make sense. The other thing that I hope people stop saying is return to work. I'm like, what do you think we were doing in the past couple of years? Like hanging out in the beach and drinking piña colada in Cancun? Come on. I mean, we have been working our butts off over the past couple of years. Yeah. People are significantly overworked, more than they were before, not just from what they are doing with their jobs, but also they have families at home, sickness, illnesses, you know, with COVID. The kids, if they have kids running around at home because they are being homeschooled now or connecting online. So people have been working way more than they ever worked before. So it's not a return to work. If you want people to return to your office, well, you call it that way. You call it return to the office. I just hope that people don't do that and don't force anybody to go back to the office. But I think to me, this idea of going back to normal, it is like, didn't we learn anything from the past couple of years? I mean, why do we want to return to something that wasn't working? Let's just do better. Let's create something different, something better, something. This is the way, sort of the analogy that I use. We entered into a dark tunnel when we went through COVID, and there's light that we left behind, but that light was not shining upon everybody. It was shining upon a few people. What I'm hoping is that the moment that we're out of this dark tunnel with COVID and political polarization and racial and social unrest, I am hoping that the light that we see at the end of the tunnel is a light that shines upon everybody and not just upon the few. So that to me is like, no way I want to return to what we had before.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more on that. We've talked about the events. I've mentioned at the beginning that you have Hacking HR podcast as well that is running very frequently. How did you start that? What are the conversations you're having there? Do you have some maybe key findings, interesting learnings, surprising learnings for yourself from that as well?
You know, I think at this point, because I've heard so many things
anymore.
Yeah, it's just like we've recorded almost 400 podcasts in a year and probably like 5 months. So it's a daily podcast. The only month that we took off was January of this year because we wanted to give ourselves a little break. we had done the podcast continuously for 14 months, you know, every day for 14 months. That's a lot of podcast episodes. Yes. Our podcast episodes are short, you know, 15 plus minutes. So it's very short, very quick conversations. But I think I've heard so many different things. And I think to me, one of the most, more than a finding in itself, it's been more the connectivity between what everybody wants from work, what everybody else thinks is a necessity in terms of how we should think about work going forward. I say this because I see a lot of people, a lot of HR leaders that I invite to the show saying the same things. You know, we have to care for the human. We have to build human workplaces where we find purpose, meaning, flow. We have to care for the mental health and the human experience of our people. And it's not just the grind that we have done for a long time anymore. So the overlap of ideas and opinions about these things, that's, to me, it's one of the most striking findings. Because, you know, it's not like I interview 400 people and the 400 of them have said different things or disagreeing with each other. In fact, it is like pretty much there's a thread connecting all that these leaders are looking for. So that's been very exciting.
Yeah. Now, our audience is more real estate, workplace manager side of things. And since I've been in the profession, it's always been said that HR and those types of profiles need to work closely together. And I think now more than ever, because of that highlighted focus on employee well-being and experience. From the conversations you're having, from the events you're leading and the speeches you're having on, what part does the workplace or the physical office play in employee experience and well-being from the point of view of HR?
Yeah. Recently, I had a conversation with someone, and between the two of us in the conversation, we acknowledged that there's like an onion kind of analogy here. The outer layer, the bigger layer of that onion is to think about the humans, to think about human experience. And that is a very broad sort of approach to the humans that work for us, not just as employees, but also as the humans they are in the holistic sense of the word. Then the inner layer, or the first inner layer under that human experience, is employee experience. How do we improve the experience of those humans by that work? How can we provide them with the experiences that truly give them the best opportunities for growth, for learning, for unleashing their potential and whatnot? Another inner layer below that is what we call the workplace experience. And what that means is the specific experience that they get from the actual workplace, not as in the work they do or as in their jobs, but from the physical workplace. And in our conversation, we said that thinking differently about workplace experience means thinking differently about what it means to be together with other people in a physical space. Traditionally, going to a workplace, going to a physical building for work meant you having your desk to sit and have all your meetings at work and your computer at work and all your interactions, both with your coworkers or your clients, in that physical space. Now it is a little bit different because people are doing a lot of those interactions online. So the question becomes, what do we want the workplace experience? What do we want the physical workplace experience to be? Do we want people to come here to sit in a computer and be doing the same grind that they could do from home? The answer is probably not, because if they could do it from home versus doing it from an office and they avoid a 2-hour commute, then they will come back. They won't come to the office. But if you provide them with opportunities, for example, for collaboration, for innovation, for problem solving, for social interactions at work, in the workplace, in the physical space, then you're providing something that they don't get in whatever they're working from, home or whatever it is. So that inner layer is, I think, what pertains the most to your community, which is how do we redesign the experience of what being in a physical space together with your coworker, what that means for each employee. So one question that emerges here that I am hoping that your community can, I don't necessarily have a specific answer, but I'm challenging them to think about it, is the question is, why would people come to your physical space if you had that office? Why would they go there instead of staying at home, right? What experience are you offering them in that building that you have available to them that is different from the experience that they are getting at home, which is sitting with their sleepers and their shorts and hanging out and not having to commute? So you got to provide them with something that is so significantly much better and valuable that they will want to go to that physical space, not necessarily all the time, but maybe every now and then. So that requires a complete different thinking in terms of the physical space. And in that conversation of what that means, HR is involved because we have the other two layers, the layers of employee experience and the layer of human experience that are very much connected to the layer of workplace experience. So that's why now you see a transition of corporate real estate or physical space professionals reporting to, for example, finance to now HR. Starting to report to HR, right? Because it's an onion, right? It's, you have the different layers, but they are all interconnected.
Yeah. And we have a lot of new types of job titles emerging as well, like head of remote experience, head of employee experience that hadn't been separate roles necessarily before, or not with those labels at least. What I'm constantly thinking about is like a problem. And I just want to hear your view on that. Maybe you do have a solution for it. And it's like, employee experience, employee well-being, it's really hard to measure.
Yeah.
How do you find out if the workplace you're putting in place, if the programs you're running, if the support you're offering are a success?
Yeah, well, you have to rely on data and the right metrics, right? There are things not just in employee experience and engagement, but in general, that don't have a direct indicator or a direct metric. And then you're going to need some proxies that science shows. These proxies truly show a correlation between two things. For example, I remember, and I'm going to use this as an example because I had this conversation a while ago and it was very interesting. This company was analyzing employees' metadata from their emails. So not looking at their content or anything, just the metadata. And they realized that there was a close connection between the amount of emails that people send versus the likelihood of them leaving that company. And they said, when people, yeah, I'm talking about a study done by this company like 3 years ago. I don't know how far they've gone with this data. And I would not, for everybody who's listening to this podcast conversation, I mean, don't rely on this that I'm saying right now because it was one study and you can find out if it's true or not. But it was very interesting because what they found out in that company was that with a decrease in the amount of interactions and emails that every person was sending in their company, especially when those emails were coming to other teams, they realized that the likelihood of them leaving the company within the next like 6 months was higher. So that was like very interesting because, you know, who would have thought that there was a correlation between the amount of emails that you send and the fact that you were going to leave the company within the next 6 months, which totally makes sense, by the way, because, you know, in my own personal case, I remember I have had several jobs in my career. And when this person told me that, I reflected and I said, that's true, because I used to send so many emails, you know, to everybody, connecting and having conversations and whatnot. And at the end of my tenure in those organizations, especially because I was pretty disengaged, my amount of emails decreased. And I looked at it in my Outlook. I looked at how many emails I had sent every year. And I said, wow, you know, like, you know, in 2013, I sent 25,000 emails. In 2016, it was like 20. Then in 2017, it went down to like 12. And I'm like, something's going on here. I mean, my job is still complex, but I am sending less emails, maybe because I don't want to do the job anymore, you know, and I actually left. Anyway, I'm using this example because there are many proxies that you can use to measure experience, to measure culture, to measure engagement. There's a lot of studies out there that you can look at. Of course, I know a few of them. I'm not familiar with all of them, but there are other proxies that can help you sort of resolve these questions. For example, the relationship with your manager. That's a big indicator of whether you are engaged or disengaged, because that's an indicator of your opportunities to grow in that company provided by your direct inline manager or inline leader. And there's a likelihood that if your relationship with that person in data shows a sour or that it's a poor relationship with that line manager, you can correlate that with the people that are leaving your organization. And you may find, most likely, that the people that have the poorest relationship with their managers are the people that are either asking to be transferred to other units or that are leaving those jobs. So that's proxy data for engagement. That belongs to the larger, engagement is another layer, by the way. I should have mentioned that in my onion before. Human experience, employee experience, engagement, and then workplace experience. But you can use some of that data to show interesting findings. Let me go back to one about workplace experience, something that people may want to look into. for example, you are rebuilding your workplace and you're running a few experiments, right? And you are, for example, tearing down some offices and building more communal social spaces. And you find out that maybe the people that work, I'm just going to make it up. I'm not saying that this is true. I'm just going to make it up right now. Maybe you find out 6 months later that after building those spaces, the people that are coming to the office, the most frequent are the people who work, for example, in technology teams and who are closer to the headquarter where you build that space. That tells you something. If you build a space that is only used for people who work in technology and not people who work in other areas, you may start sort of making some inferences or conclusions or taking some ideas out of that data. You may wonder, why are the people who work in other areas, like, for example, sales, marketing, human resources, why are they not using that space? And then you start finding out and you have conversations with them and you ask them, hey, we built this space. We thought you guys were going to use it. You're not using it that much. What's going on? So that kind of proxy can truly provide a lot of great insights. So you have to be very creative into looking at existing metrics, but also metrics that your gut feeling is probably telling you, I want to measure this thing to see what's going on here.
Which is a new skill set for lots of workplace managers. I'm thinking like having this more data scientific approach to things. And at the same time, I also think if you look at these proxies, you always need to take them with a grain of salt, right? You know, of course. With that email, it's like, okay, it can be an indication, but we shouldn't lean too heavily on it because it is not one-on-one kind of. So it's like, you need to have a well-balanced view on this information and probably put it together with different proxies.
That's exactly what I was going to say. You have to put that together with other indicators. One data point is not enough. If you're measuring just one metric, that's not enough, right? I mean, you have to compare that to other metrics. And then you start looking, for example, you say, people who are sending less emails, this other company, Company A, found out that people who send less emails are more likely to leave that company within the next 6 months after we took that measurement. And then you say, well, that worked for Company A. Let me look at some things in my company. And then you start looking, for example, let me look at the people who are sending less emails, whose email amount changed by, say, 10% over the past 1 year. Let me look at their relationship with their manager. Let me look at if they have mentors or coaches in the organization. Let me look at their tenure in the organization. Let me look at their age bracket, at their gender, their sexual identity, their race, where they are located physically. And then you combine all of those data points and you create a story out of that. One data point is not enough. And that's what happens very often in the workplace, that we look at one data point and we want to create conclusions out of that data point, and that's not enough. You have to combine a lot of data points that help you create a story. And then you find out, and again, I'm going to be making this up. You're going to have to, for everybody who's listening to this podcast, you will have to figure it out in your own reality. But then you, for example, find something like the people who send less emails, yes, they are more likely to leave the company within the next 6 months after we took that measure. But we also found that it happened to be people from minorities, maybe women of color. And it happened that these women of color had the poorest relationship with their managers, meaning that probably their learning opportunities or their growth opportunities were poorer than anybody else in the company. So that tells you something, that it's not just that they are leaving because they are sending less emails, it's that there's something else going on in there. And that's how you design the right interventions to fix not the amount of emails that they are sending, but the bottom line problem, which is this subgroup here, this target group, this niche group in the company, which is women of color, maybe who are in the younger generation and who live farther away from the company, they are the ones with the poorest relationship with their manager. So we got to find out why, we got to ask questions, and then we got to design an intervention for this group. I think this is fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, it's just like, first of all, like, being a technologist like I am, to me, this is fascinating because imagine creating interventions for such a personalized approach, because you truly are targeting the very niche group that needs those interventions. And by the way, I want to bring the word equity or equality here. If you say everybody who is sending less emails, 10% less emails in a 1 year period are likely to leave in 6 months. So let's design an intervention for all of them. But that's a bad design because probably it's not all of them that you need to work with in the same approach. So maybe you start identifying these niche groups and designing personalized interventions for each of those groups. To me, this is fascinating, absolutely fascinating. and one of the next frontiers for HR to add so much significant value.
Yeah, you got me on the edge of my seat with that as well, because I was now thinking workplace realm. We're talking a lot about office utilization now, and obviously our company does office utilization as well. And we've had customers well asking us, like, now what is the new benchmark for utilization of different workplace types? And I'm like, wait, that's not what you need to look at. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. What you need to first think about, what do you want people to do in the office?
Yeah.
And then the other question that's also, I think, discussed a lot in the media, in panels and whatever I see, is like, okay, what now if people only come in on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and then Monday and Friday, the office is empty? And what if there's like 100% and the capacity is like at the edge on these 3 days? And I'm thinking, like, yes, okay, it's not ideal if Monday and Friday the office is empty, and maybe we can find creative uses for that space, hopefully in the future. But you should be happy that people are coming Tuesday to Thursday, because that means they want to be there and connect with their colleagues. You should be worried if they're never showing up.
Yeah. Well, let me share a couple of things about that. The first one is forcing anybody to do anything will never work. And what I'm saying here is, I've had conversations with HR leaders who have told me, my CEO is telling me to ask people to come 3 days a week. And I ask those HR leaders, why? And they're like, well, because that's the way we want to work. Yeah, but I'm like, that's not an answer. I mean, you can tell somebody, you have to come 3 days a week. And if they ask you why, and you tell them, because that's the way we want to work, that's not an answer. I mean, that's not an answer. They can say, all right, that's the way you want to work. I don't like that way of working, so I'm going to quit this job, which they can do and find something else probably tomorrow. So forcing people to do anything, I don't think it works. But let me go back to your other example. What do we do with the office? You know, begin with the beginning, which is being curious. Go and ask your people. I go to talk to Sabine, and I ask, hey, Sabine, over the past couple of years, 95% of the time, you were working from home. Are you comfortable at home? And then you may say, yeah, I love working from home because I don't have to commute and I have all my things in here. And then I ask you, what do I need to do in the physical space that we have available for you to come a couple of days a week? And then you may say, well, first of all, I don't want to sit in a computer if I'm going to go to the office, because if I'm going to sit in a computer, I do it at home. What I want is that if I go there, I want to be, for example, I want to have a town hall meeting with the senior leadership, and I want that to be in person because I want to make sure that they see us and they see our engagement and our conversations and whatnot. Number two, I want to have problem solving sessions, and I'm making it up. I want to have problem solving sessions with people that are in other areas, functional areas, not just in my area. Because if it's just my area, I connect with them on Zoom. I don't need to necessarily see them in person, or I invite them for a coffee, to have coffee and lunch, and that's pretty much it. So then you ask these questions and people start telling you why would they come to an office? You know, what is the incentive for them to come to an office? And then you say, wow, you know, you get a lot of insights out of that. Some insights will reinforce maybe some preconceived ideas that you had from before, and some other insights will be like, whoa, I didn't even know that people were expecting to do something like this. And that helps with some ideas on what the direction for your workplace experience should be. Don't assume that you know if you haven't talked to the people. So you got to start by being very curious. And then, of course, you start with curiosity, you ask the questions, you run some experiments, you collect the data, and there's no rush to do any of these things, by the way. I mean, I don't see why would anybody be in a rush to bring people to the office tomorrow, especially if they have been producing the outcomes that they need to produce. Take your time to ask the questions, to have the conversations with your leaders, with your colleagues, with your direct reports, and run some experiments, you know, like a small space in the office to do the town hall, or like another small space to have more social with a purpose interaction. And I think you're going to be in a good, off to a great journey if you do something along those lines.
Yeah, I agree. There is no rush, except for when you have maybe a lease end coming up and you need to decide what you want to do with the location. I think that's where a lot of the pressures are coming from, that people are seeing. But if I want to make decisions on reducing capacity because people are working from home, I need to know how much capacity I still need. And I need to know that before the lease notice period starts. So I get that part of it. That
Well, but you know, like, it's been 2 years in COVID. So like, I mean, by now, if anybody waited the day before the lease was up, come on now. I mean, if somebody was in that camp, I mean, you wasted a significant amount of time to get ready for this. But I understand there may be some people right now that are like, my lease is expiring in 6 months. Well, you know, you got a long time to think about what you want to do. So you just have to start putting the work in and finding out. What I think it's the worst mistake is to assume that you have the answer for what people want. I think that would be a mistake. Yeah. If you assume that people want to come back to the office, that's a mistake. The same way, by the way, which is a mistake to assume that people want to work from home, because I have spoken with a lot of people that tell me, I want to have the flexibility. I don't want to work from home all the time. You know, for example, expats who work in different countries, they are like, you know, they draw their social interactions from work, from their colleagues at work. And if they are at home alone, they are like, I'm bored. You know, I want to see people, right? So for them, working at home all the time may be significantly detrimental to their mental health. So don't assume. That's the ultimate sort of foundation here. Don't assume. Ask the questions. Talk to your people.
I feel now is a good point in time to ask you a question that I ask everybody. And that is, if you could magically solve any future, I want to make it for you, of future of work, future workplace, future employee experience problem, what would it be?
If I could solve any problem,
magically,
have so, many problems.
So it can be crazy if you want to.
Magically. I would totally redesign the work experience. You know, like, I know it sounds very magic. I think the way work is designed sucks. And I begin from one principle, and it's a principle that I myself truly believe in, and I have experienced, and I have seen in other people as well. People like to work. That doesn't mean that they like their jobs. That's a totally different thing. Jobs and work are different things. People find an outlet to their creativity, their purpose, their passion, their engagement, their energy through work. But if the work experience is crappy, then it will seem as if they don't like to work. But what they don't really like is their jobs. So what I would do is I would redesign the entire work experience so that people like being in that job, not just like working, which they do, but they like being in that job. That entails a lot of things. And one of them that I would probably add in the beginning of this journey is think about how you could redesign your work experience in a way that when people come to the jobs that you're providing to them, they find not just an outlet for their creativity and their energy and their passion, but also for their purpose and their meaning. Meaning something they can say, you know what? I went to work today and I made a difference in the world. You know, I mean, when they come home and they talk to their family at home or they talk to their friends, you know, over happy hour, whatever it is, if they say, not only did I go to work today and I made a little bit of money today, but I made a difference in the world. I made the world a little bit better by my contribution today. That's a hell of a change if you can do something like that. And you can. And I am sure you can. You just have to figure it out. So that to me, if we can magically do that, woof, we're going to be off to such a different journey towards the future.
That would be great.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, I would say so.
You came on the podcast because of a recommendation. So I'm going to ask you now, who else should I have on this podcast? And is there something you would like to ask them?
Someone else. There's a person that you would love. My network is really large and I talk to so many people. So I want to make sure that for anybody who is listening to this thing, I acknowledge you all and I love you all. But just, you know, it came right off the top of my mind. My friend Gary Bowles, he is the chair for the Center of the Future of Work at Singularity University. He recently wrote a book called Next Rules of Work. I got it in, you know, somewhere around there. And he's thinking years ahead. And what he's trying to do is telling people, his approach is we got to redesign so many things, not just for today, not even for tomorrow, but for the rules of the work that we're going to see in the next, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30 years. So it's a very futuristic approach, but also very tangible. And he's very inspiring. And I think he's amazing. So I would say invite him. And the question that I would ask him is, I would ask him, where would you begin this journey? If you can, the same question that you asked me, you know, like similar, if there was one step that everybody can touch and say, I can walk that step. You're not telling me, change the world tomorrow. No, you're telling me, drink water. I can do that. I can go and pour some water in my glass and drink some water if that's what you want me to do. Something that people can actually make happen. That's what I would ask him.
That's a great suggestion. I will do that. Thank you very much for the whole conversation. It was a great pleasure to pick your brain on some of the things.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for listening. If you have enjoyed this episode of The Workplace Leader, there's more. Go visit our blog and have a look at some of the other topics we have covered. We've just released the Definitive Guide to Workplace Analytics, for instance. Or tune into our next episode of The Workplace Leader.